Canada, a country which prides itself on its democracy, its multiculturalism, and its tolerant nature, yet also a country which carried out the uprooting, internment, and dispossession of 22,000 Japanese Canadians living along the coast of British Columbia during World War II. How do we reconcile these two images of Canada? How do we understand the rationalizations behind actions that today seem so overtly racist? These are the questions that plagued me as I started digging into archival records of these events in Canada's history. Sifting through numerous official and private communications between government officials, I couldn't help but notice the language, the justifications, the euphemisms, and at times the outright racism. It became very clear that behind these official policies of internment and dispossession were individuals in positions of power who had their own opinions, viewpoints, and biases. So, in this podcast, I want to take a closer look at what written records of government correspondence can tell us about how the dispossession of Japanese Canadians became government policy. In doing so, I hope to show that prejudiced opinions didn't just exist alongside policies of dispossession, but actually helped to create these unjust policies, which had monumental effects on the lives of Japanese Canadians. So, how did we get to the point where the Canadian government was legally interning and dispossessing its own citizens? To answer this, we need a very abbreviated history lesson. On December 7th, 1941, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. This becomes the official catalyst and justification to remove, or evacuate as the government called it, all Japanese Canadians living in the protected area along the coast of BC for, quote, reasons of national security, end quote, and begins a process of internment that lasts from 1942 to 1949. Logistically, this removal means that almost all possessions and real estate of Japanese Canadians has to be left behind. Legal guardianship of this property is forcibly turned over to the government's custodian of enemy property for safekeeping. However, it is abruptly decided in 1943 that this real estate and the majority of personal possessions will be liquidated and sold off by the government without proper consultation or consent of Japanese Canadian owners. And thus, what is now termed the dispossession of Japanese Canadians commences. Now, what I want to focus on today are letters between government officials which shed some light into the political and social climate leading up to the dispossession. On January 26, 1938, the Premier of BC, Duff Petullo, writes a confidential letter to Canadian Prime Minister Mackenzie King. In this letter, Petullo speaks of what he calls, quote, the Japanese situation, end quote, and the public agitation about the growing number of Japanese immigrants. He implores the Prime Minister to survey the Japanese population in order to see if there are, quote, Japs coming in surreptitiously, end quote, and suggests that no more Japanese immigrants be allowed entry. This letter is accompanied by a statement for the press released the same day. Petullo states, quote, I have received numerous complaints as to the activities of Orientals within our province and the manner in which they have injected themselves into our industrial and farming operations. No one can blame the Oriental for trying to make a living. The mistake has been their admission into the country, constituting, as it now does, a very serious problem. End quote. What's most significant and troubling about this statement is the dehumanizing and paternalistic way that Petullo speaks about Japanese Canadians. Collapsing an entire array of diverse people into the all-consuming category of the Oriental effectively negates the existence of their individual stories and lives as human beings. As if speaking about an unruly child, Petullo says that Japanese Canadians can't be blamed for all the problems they've caused, because Canada shouldn't have let them in the first place. The language Petullo uses is also very important. His description of Japanese Canadians overtaking our industries within our province makes a clear division between an us, the supposedly true and rightful Canadian citizens, and a them, the foreign Orientals. Never mind the fact that many individuals of Japanese heritage living on the coast were actually Canadian-born. His reference to what he calls the injection of Japanese Canadians into farming and industry also hints at one of the real reasons why they may have been so unpopular. They posed a competitive threat to white business and industry. Petullo's private and public statements suggest a pretty strong sentiment of prejudice towards individuals of Japanese heritage living in BC. They show that animosity and a desire for the removal of Japanese Canadians existed long before they were ever deemed a security threat. These statements also can't be brushed off as the ideas of a few racist citizens. When the Premier of BC is openly discussing these matters with the Prime Minister, It is clear that a negative attitude towards Japanese Canadians has not only reached those in high positions of power, but has also become acceptable to voice. All right, so now let's move ahead to August 1942. The process of uprooting and removing Japanese Canadians from within the protected area has been underway since February of this year. The official liquidation of Japanese Canadian-owned property has not yet begun, but the Soldier Settlement Board of Canada is in the process of surveying these properties to determine their suitability for being purchased by the government for returning war veterans. On August 27th, the District Superintendent of the Soldier Settlement Board in Canada, Ivan T. Barnett, writes a letter deemed personal and confidential to his boss in Ottawa, Gordon Murchison, the director of the Soldier Settlement Board. Barnett describes some of the daily struggles of surveying and managing these properties, the clamoring of veterans to lease these lands, and the complaints of canning companies losing money over berry shortages. What is most telling about Barnett's letter, however, are his words regarding Japanese Canadians. He writes, quote, "The more I think about the Japanese problem, the more I feel that, as the government has committed itself to an expenditure that will run into millions, it is essential to see the thing through, and these people should be cleared entirely off this coast regardless of where they were born." End quote. This quote really echoes the dehumanizing sentiment that Petullo expressed in his statements. Japanese Canadians are reduced down to a costly problem that the government just needs to buckle down and deal with. Barnett doesn't just stop here, though. He mentions a rumor that the properties Japanese Canadians bought along the coastline were actually strategically selected so that they could house Japanese troops in the event that Japan ever invaded Canada. He also expresses his incredulity that one of his employees, who surveyed a property, was told by the Japanese Canadian owners that they had not made plans to rent their farm because the government was responsible for taking care of it. Barnett scathingly says, quote, "I have no doubt that many of these people think they can hold the government responsible for any destruction or deterioration in their holdings, and, when this war is over, if they have any money, no doubt they will be able to find some white lawyer who will go into the courts with any kind of fantastic case." End quote. This letter is especially striking because it lacks the veil of professional restraint that lies over a lot of the official government correspondence about the dispossession. In this letter, Barnett is venting the personal opinions and suspicions that he can't necessarily say officially. He is also not technically correct. Under federal policy at this time, the custodian of enemy property had legally promised to hold Japanese Canadian property in trust and preserve it until it could be released back to its owners. It wasn't until policy changes in early 1943 that the forced sale of these properties was made legal. I think what Barnett's statements really highlight is a certain interpretation of the true intention behind these policies. Like Petullo, Barnett believes that the government's best course of action would be the permanent removal of all persons of Japanese descent from the coast. In this view, placing control of Japanese Canadian-owned properties in the hands of the custodian was just a logical first step towards dispossession and the ultimate goal of ensuring Japanese Canadians had no homes to come back to. Barnett's language also implies that what qualifies as being Canadian is based on supposed racial heritage than citizenship. Even being born in Canada isn't enough to qualify Japanese Canadians for the same rights and freedoms that other citizens and immigrants have. Instead, Barnett categorizes all Japanese Canadians into the racialized group of these people who need to be, quote, "cleared entirely off this coast regardless of where they were born," end quote. His comments about the responsibility of government are also important. There is a certain level of contempt in his tone for Japanese Canadians whom he thinks will try to get compensation for their hardship. He describes it in his letter by saying, quote, "I liken these holdings to the carcass of a fish, with the gulls all sitting around feeding on it. It appears to me that everybody, including the Japanese owners, is out to get everything possible from these properties." In his mind, Japanese Canadians are just trying to take advantage of the situation, and he doesn't seem to have any understanding of how the dispossession may be genuinely distressing or unjust. Now, the last letter I want to talk about is also related to Japanese Canadian-owned farmland. It was written on December 12th of that same year by Glenn W. McPherson, director of the Vancouver Office of the Custodian of Enemy Property. He is writing a response to Ephraim H. Coleman, the Undersecretary of State in Ottawa, who sent McPherson a letter seeking his advice. Coleman had asked McPherson for his opinion on what should be done about agricultural lands owned by interned Japanese Canadians and whether the Soldier Settlement Board of Canada should take over the custodian's responsibility for these properties. McPherson recommends that the Office of the Custodian should liquidate all Japanese Canadian-owned property as soon as possible. He reasons that these farms will deteriorate quickly without proper owners and may soon stop bringing in enough revenue to cover costs. He also suggests that all Japanese-Canadian-owned chattels, or possessions other than real estate, should be sold off as well. He states, quote, "I realize the danger of such a policy, insofar as it might cause dissatisfaction among evacuees, but the deterioration of real property and the loss of chattels will soon liquidate all capital investment. At the present time, evacuees are encouraged to release encumbered property where they have no real equity and to approve reasonable sales," end quote. Now, McPherson's choice of words is really important here. As with many official documents, the removal of Japanese Canadians is referred to rather euphemistically as the evacuation. Evacuees are encouraged to sell their property and approve reasonable sales. It gives the picture that Japanese Canadians had a lot more say in the matter than they actually did. McPherson's letter also suggests that the same Ivan Barnett previously discussed should be given the power to lease properties, supervise farming operations, and eventually work towards transferring property to the government. Interestingly, McPherson argues against transferring the power to actually sell Japanese-Canadian-owned properties from the Office of the Custodian to the Soldier Settlement Board. His reasoning is that while the custodian is officially tasked with lessening the economic burden for Japanese-Canadians in the government, the Soldier Settlement Board is responsible for getting the best land for veterans and is not really concerned with getting fair deals for Japanese Canadians. McPherson worried that transferring control would inflame Japanese Canadians because they may think their interests aren't being looked after. His phrasing suggests that what concerns him most about the situation is not actually the well-being of Japanese Canadians, but rather the hassle of dealing with potential backlash. Likewise, his recommendation that Barnett, who has some pretty strong anti-Japanese Canadian sentiment, be given more power over Japanese-Canadian-owned farmlands again shows a real lack of concern for the best interests of the owners. Now, this letter is not as scandalous or overtly racist as the previous two, but it highlights a few really important things about policy. McPherson recognizes that interned Japanese-Canadians will probably not be very happy about their property being sold, but this is quickly deemed less significant than the potential financial loss for the government. He makes a rational cost-benefit analysis of the situation and decides that liquidation is the best policy. What's noticeably absent from this decision is any real thought about the financial, emotional, and logistical costs to Japanese Canadians who will suddenly have all their homes and worldly possessions gone. McPherson may not display overt racism in his letter, but his policy suggestions effectively rank the needs of Japanese Canadians as lower than financial profit. It's important to note here that McPherson used the same argument of real estate being perishable to justify the sale of urban properties owned by Japanese Canadians in Vancouver. Records show that McPherson was in fact a major orchestrator of the entire dispossession and was also thought by some to be a, quote, "Jap hater," end quote. If this is in fact the case, then it tells us that McPherson used his racism in a strategic and effective way. Rather than openly displaying hostility, he channeled his views into advocating for seemingly rational and objective policies that were able to achieve the goal of removing Japanese Canadians from the coast. By taking this approach, McPherson and many other politicians were able to construct a rationale for the dispossession that made it about finances rather than racism. So, what is the significance of this correspondence? What can three simple letters tell us about the dispossession? Well, these letters are examples which show that departments and officials directly involved in influencing policies of dispossession displayed little concern for the interests of Japanese Canadians. In fact, they often express open hostility or mistrust. The language they use also sheds light onto how people come to justify and rationalize seemingly unjust policies. Branding Japanese Canadians as untrustworthy foreigners created a fictitious threat that then justified the government's actions toward them. Similarly, arguing that Japanese-Canadian properties would lose value if not sold framed the dispossession as a financial decision instead of a prejudiced one. These rationalizations helped to create a narrative of the internment and dispossession in which injustices and human rights violations were necessary measures for protecting the national security and financial interests of Canada in a time of war. Understanding how the personal prejudices and opinions of individuals in positions of power shaped the history of dispossession is also crucial. As historian Jordan Stanger Ross aptly notes, quote, "In the hands of other figures, the story of Japanese-Canadian-owned property might have ended differently," end quote. In other words, unjust policies or laws are not objective things that somehow just come into being. Rather, they are actively crafted, created, and enacted by individuals who, like everyone else, have their own biases and opinions. Behind all historical events are imperfect people, governments, and societies whose decisions, both good and bad, created the history we have today. So if there's any message to be taken from this podcast, it is this. While it is easy to look at the past and write off people like Petulu or Burnett simply as racists, it is harder to acknowledge that none of us are fully immune to prejudice or bias. We all have our own opinions and ideas which shape the professional and private decisions we make. By recognizing our own blind spots or biases, however, we can try to make sure that our own small actions don't contribute to larger injustices or mistreatment. We can't change the decisions or policies which led to the internment and dispossession of Japanese Canadians. But we can learn from this history and do everything in our power to not let the injustices of the past be repeated in the present.